Welcome back to The Hopeless Romantic. I'm Austin Chant.
I'm Amanda Jean.
And today we are here to talk about villains.
Woo! And anti-heroes.
Villains in queer romance. And this is actually the first episode we've done in a really long time that was just us. I'm all excited.
I know. This feels so much more relaxed. Not that we don't like having guests. We absolutely love it. But there definitely is more pressure. And there's also the idea that something could go terribly wrong.
Usually with recording. Like, mm-hmm. I'm usually not so much worried about our conversations. Those are lovely. But Skype likes to misbehave as soon as someone that we love and respect is on the other end of the line.
Yeah, it really does. Skype, this is not an endorsement for this product. We do not endorse Skype. But yeah, I'm really excited about this episode. We've had it kind of on our list and in the works for a while now. And if you've listened to THR for any length of time, you know that Austin and I are all about that queer villainy. So we've got a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about how to write queer villains, great examples of queer villains, the difference between a villain and an anti-hero. And be warned, there will be a lot of teal deer about our favorite villains in literature and other places.
Yeah, so when we were brainstorming this topic, obviously one of the things that came up first was how often queerness exists in our literature, media, kind of in general, in a modern context, but also in a historical context, as something that connotes villainy, like all on its own. And that's obviously screwed up, but it also means that a lot of young queer folks, myself included, grow up identifying with a lot of villain characters because they exhibit traits that are coded as queer. And when you're a baby queer, I think a lot of times you either see those things and go, oh, that's me. I love Scar from The Lion King. Or you go, oh, that's not me, so I must not be queer because I have nothing in common with Scar from The Lion King.
Or you feel like it's just more evidence that being queer is a bad thing.
Yep. So obviously that's screwed up, but at the same time, some of those representations can be really kind of important in the lives of young queer folks. Again, myself included.
Definitely.
And man, did we not have any shortage when we tried to brainstorm queer villains for this.
No, I was surprised because definitely I wanted to come at it from the angle of literature first. And there are some great queer villains in fiction. However, the majority of them are in movies, TV, and video games. So we're going to be talking about queer villainy in different mediums, but also just in general, like how you write a convincing villain, an interesting villain, and then also anti-heroes of that ilk. So do we wanna talk about some queer-coded villains? Like you mentioned Scar.
Yeah, let's dive in with some examples. I know you have some meaty examples coming up.
Is that a pun?
Yes. I'm sorry. I'm ashamed.
Oh God, I'm ashamed of us both. But I consulted a few lists that I found on Google, but really most of this was, you know, Austin and I sitting around thinking about villains that were important to us in good and bad ways. And then the obvious ones that get mentioned a lot are Scar, Jafar. Who did you mention? You mentioned Ursula from the
Ursula,
Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ursula is based on a real life drag queen.
Divine. I was going to say, too, like, when I started thinking about characters who are coded as queer, it's gotten weirdly more... Actually, no, it's gotten less overt over the years because queer people have taken a bigger, more prominent role in mainstream media in less negative ways in the last, like, 10, 15 years. So it's a little bit different because before, I felt like queer coding was more subliminal. And now you have stuff like, I thought of Moriarty in the BBC Sherlock show, which again, not an endorsement, but in his way of like staying below the radar when interacting with Sherlock, the first time he pretends to be a gay dude. And I thought it was interesting that like, that's the level we're at now. Like villains are actively aping queerness.
Yeah.
like it's not just like some weird implied thing. Like, no, this is a tool in their wheelhouse that they're using. I don't know. It's a funny change. I thought of, because I'm a huge fan of Thomas Harris and the movies and TV made of his canon. And I thought of Buffalo Bill as one of the worst examples of a queer villain or a queer-coded villain, because not only is he, I'm pretty sure he's gay. Yeah. Not only is he gay, but they also did some weird thing where they were like, he thinks he's trans, but he's not trans. Also, he's a serial killer. So I think that's one of the most egregious examples. And then I even thought of like Xerxes from 300.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty much everywhere when you start breaking it down. And even if they're not in like big ways where you look at a character and you're like, oh, they're definitely coded as queer, you still kind of see it in smaller character choices, like how they're dressed, if they're particularly well-dressed, the type of clothes that they wear, the way that they speak, if they're sort of portrayed as being like sissy-ish, which mm-hmm. was a huge thing. And then Austin, I know you've definitely done a lot of research on queer coding, so...
Yeah, I've done a lot of investigation into video games, which is sort of my other life outside of queer romance. I kind of thought of like, right off the top of my head, like three major villains who are pretty well regarded in games, who are all queer men, who are actually canonically queer, and who are horrifying, like, villainous portrayals, except for the last one, who is like a little less screwed up. But yeah, if you just jump into video games, one of them, a villain who is actually pretty well regarded as like a great arch villain, is Sander Cohen from the BioShock series, who exemplifies the like murdery fey artist type, who is also very femme, and who, like, you do quests for him and it's to go around murdering all his ex-boyfriends.
Who hasn't wanted to do that?
Like... he's portrayed as very predatory. And that's actually something that ties into MF romance, in that I have seen quite a number of bi or gay villains in MF romance who are treated as like extra bad because they're sexually predatory towards men. That is absolutely something that comes off in video games a lot.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I actually was reminded that the villain in Outlander, or at least one of the villains in Outlander, is explicitly bi, and, like, it adds to his evilness.
Yeah, it's like, and in video games, you often have this situation where you have a player who is kind of implicitly assumed to be a man, and the idea that villains are extra bad if they are sexually interested in, and therefore innately predatory towards men. And you also see that in the other kind of really nasty portrayal of queer masculinity in games that I could think of, which is Reaver from the Fable series, who just by his name alone, you know, is a swell dude. Interesting about Reaver, he's actually played by Stephen Fry, who is gay.
Actual queer man, yeah.
Actual queer man.
Also not an endorsement, sorry.
Yes. Reaver is just like, in the third installment in the series, he... just holds murder orgies, like, where everybody has a good time having, like, a gladiatory pit in the middle of the, like, extravagant, lush music hall they're in, and then, like, werewolves show up and kill all the guests, and he's in the middle, like, this is what bisexuality is.
How dare, like, I didn't know that we were talking about, like, the group meetings. I thought that that was a DL thing. Like, I thought no one was supposed to know about the werewolves in the murder pit.
Yeah. And at the same time, there's a weird transphobic edge to his portrayal. Mm-hmm. I'm getting deja vu. Have I talked about Reaver before?
No, not on THR, but probably in your life.
I have talked about Reaver a lot because I love to talk about queerness in video games and cry. There's a weird, like, transphobic
like
and femphobic. Jesus, Amanda.
Anyway, continue.
There's a weird, like, transphobic and femphobic undercurrent to his character too. There's a there's this interesting thing that Fable does where on the loading screens you get like propaganda posters for various like businesses or armies or whatever, like, in the world. And there's one for Reaver Industries because he's an industrial tycoon, and his like creepiness is also very much tied to this idea of like excess and blah blah blah,
debauchery.
Yes. And then as you get further in the game, those posters that you see start to be defaced by like angry civilians, and the one for Reaver is defaced so that it like puts him in lipstick And I think the original poster says something like Reaver is the face of industry, or Reaver is industry is what it says. And they've scrawled that out and replaced it with Reaver is a deviant.
Oh,
and
I forgot about that.
Like, that's super like homophobic and transphobic, but the character is set up to totally validate that assumption. Like,
yeah, it's not subverted at all.
Like, he literally is like horribly deviant in that he hosts murder orgies. Like, and so those are kind of the queer characters that I grew up with in video games. And I will say I aggressively loved both of those characters because they were kind of it. Like, and so I was very much one of those kids who was like, I love this character because they are evil and gay, just like me. And then last year, there was actually a really interesting kind of subversion of that in the new Assassin's Creed game, Syndicate, where there is a queer villain in it, but the central male protagonist is bisexual and has this kind of really interesting screwed up relationship with him. And that one was a really interesting case because for the first time you saw a like kind of very classically styled queer villain who I think has homages to the Joker and to Sander Cohen in the development of his character, paired with a queer protagonist who is reciprocating and who is also having like a kind of a terrible queer sexual awakening in response to this queer villain, very much like actual queer people do. And so I found that fascinating and super validating because I was, you know, looking at the protagonist and being like, oh, it's like your queer villain is in your real life. And you didn't just have like, you know, a little gay awakening on the other side of a TV screen. You're having it in your reality.
The real queer villains were the friends we made along the way.
But yeah, so that was a really fascinating one. And that's kind of that's a lot of the quote unquote literary canon that I come from when I think about villains is through video games, where if you see queerness, or at least it's starting to get better, but for the longest time, if you saw queerness, it was very much through the lens of an assumed like cis straight dude gamer feeling very kind of like vaguely titillated, but mostly afraid and horrified of the idea of queer men.
Well, yeah, it's like this weird undercurrent of the threat of sexual violence or sexual manipulation, which is weird because the times that you would more commonly expect to see that are with video games where the player or the avatar of the player is female. So I always thought that that was interesting. Like, it's almost like a role reversal, but gross.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting to then see kind of that same trope pop up in MF romance when it pops up, because it's feels very similar, except that the presumed reader is a cis straight woman who is kind of like, I don't know, he's coming for me and my man.
Yeah, he's dangerous. He could hurt my man. He could emasculate my man.
Yeah. Lord of Scoundrels is another example of a book where that happens. The male villain is bi, and that makes him extra gross or something.
So you come at it from a, like, this is the thing, when we were sitting down to plot this, like, the good news in most queer romance spaces is that a lot of the authors are going to be sensitive to this trope, and while there may be villains in the books who are queer, like, they're not going to fall victim to as many of the same pitfalls where they still may be predatory, but, like, everyone in the book is queer, or, you know, most everyone in the book is queer, so there's no, like, he might, you know, take advantage of me, he might change me, he might manipulate me, like, his being gay is a terrifying thing.
Yeah.
And so you don't have that, but you definitely do. One of the things we wanted to talk about is ineffective villains, like how to make villains not work for your how to make them not work for your story. Exactly, we're gonna teach you how to do that. But no, just the idea that you have a villain in your story who is queer and you don't make the most of that. Like, you don't write a compelling villain, a complicated villain, and they're just sort of like twirling their mustache and filling a narrative purpose.
And being extra evil because they're queer in some way.
Or I guess I was thinking, like, I guess the more common trope in queer romance would be the straight villain, which is actually true now that I think about it. Like the homophobic villain.
That comes up a lot. That is an interesting one, because I'm actually kind of really tired of it.
Yeah.
Like, so often the villainy is sort of homophobia in general, and it's not necessarily that that's bad, but I'm kind of tired of queer stories with villains not having villains who are compelling in their own right.
That are just caricatures of prejudice.
Because I think one of the things you want with a really good villain is you want to be able to see things from their perspective. And if you are, at least for me, if you're a queer person reading queer romance and you run into a character who is just like an out and out, like, nasty homophobe, there's nothing in that that is going to be like, oh yeah, I kind of see where you're coming from. Or like, yeah, you have a complicated goal and motivation that contrast with the protagonist. When it's like, your goal and motivation is just to shut down the existence of queer people, no one cares about you.
There's also less to be mined there. Like, that's been done, you know, in perpetuity in historically for a long time, because it's a reality that a lot of queer people have faced. So to set up, you know, caricatures of intolerance and prejudice, you know, I'm not saying that, like, we've completely tapped that, but it's gotten to the point where it's not that interesting. Like, we all kind of know what it looks like. It's always roughly the same, you know, color. It's always the same tone. I actually read a book recently where the villainy was not even particular people. It was, again, like you said, like, just kind of homophobia. And it was a contemporary story. And again, like, we certainly haven't gotten to the point in society where this isn't something that queer people face every single day of their life. But, like, the level of homophobia was so, I don't know. Like, it was like, you know, it was kind of like a joke to me. Like, it got to a point where I was like, is everyone in this story except for the main characters homophobic? Like, have they never met a queer person in their entire lives? So it's one of those things where if you're reading queer romance, you either have experienced homophobia or you are aware of homophobia. It's like, I need this book to do something else. I need this book to make me feel like the villain is compelling. And that isn't compelling to me. And there's that adage, that old adage about how every villain is the hero of their own story. And if you write a good enough villain, they are. Like, you read that villain, you understand them. And even if you're like, oh, okay. Shakes head. All right.
Yeah. Which is why I think villains who are queer can be such an interesting trope, especially in queer romance. Because I think there's a lot buried in internalized homophobia and potentially internalized transphobia. I see that less often. But you get into those situations where your villain is somebody who is trying to figure something out about themselves. And that puts them in opposition to other queer people. But they fundamentally are someone who is confused, who is figuring stuff out. And I think that is a potentially more compelling trope that a lot of people do gravitate towards.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like if you're in a situation where you're figuring something out about yourself or you know, that's an issue of conflict, like you're more prone to self-preservation and self-protection. And when people are like that, they're a little bit ruthless. They tend to, you know, throw other people under the bus. And like, while that's understandable from their particular perspective, and you might have some empathy for them, like, it doesn't mean that they're not doing something bad. So that's, you know, again, an area of potential villainy, of potential antagonism.
I wouldn't call this villainy because it'd be a little over the top. But as for a specific example, I was rereading Burnt Toast B&B, which I know you haven't read.
No, I haven't.
You got to read that book. I love Burnt Toast B&B. It's a contemporary romance by Heidi Blow and Rachel Heimowitz with a trans main character. And the other love interest has so much internalized, like, macho homophobia. It's not even quite homophobia. It is truly, like, toxic masculinity, but it comes out in it manifests in shades of homophobia and in occasionally in light shades of transphobia. And I think that's a really an interesting example of a protagonist who is as close to the villain of his own story as you can get. And you, actually, Heidi also does that in Straight Shooter, which is another book by Heidi Below, which deals with a main character who is so deep in toxic masculinity and homophobia that they become the villain, even though they're the main character.
Yeah, they're the villain of their own story.
Yeah.
It shows you how much villains don't have to be like a singular figure and don't have to be an outside source. Like, you can be your own obstacle. You can be the thing that, you know, ruins your day. You can be the thing that throws a wrench into your own plans. And I think Straight Shooter is a great example of that, because I mean, who would be the protagonist? Who would be the protagonist in that story? Sorry, Heidi. No one's the protagonist. No, who would be the antagonist if it weren't what was the character in Straight Shooter?
Austin.
Ah, shit. If it weren't Austin.
Yep. Who would it be if not me?
It wasn't actually Austin's internalized, like, homophobia and toxic masculinity. It was you sitting on his shoulder whispering things.
Yeah.
It was you, and yeah, it was you all along. Do you want me to talk about what we all know I'm going to talk about?
Yeah, why don't you just fucking dive right in?
All right. You did ask for it. The people clamored. So I mentioned that I'm a really big fan of Thomas Harris, who wrote the Hannibal Lecter series. And if you pay any attention at all to me, you know that I really liked the show Hannibal, which was canceled. Probably for the best, but it was canceled. And one of the interesting things about watching that show for me was because I had grown up reading the Hannibal Lecter series and watching all of the movies, like, Lecter never particularly read as queer to me. Like, he didn't read as particularly straight either. He was just sort of othered. So when I started watching the show and I knew that Brian Fuller is a gay man, I was kind of like, is all this weird subtext here, or am I just too gay to function? Like, what's happening? Is this real? I don't know if this is real. Is it just the way that Lecter's coded because he's dressed exquisitely, his taste is exquisite, he's European, which we all know is code. I was like, I can't tell if this is like what's really going on. And for, I went like two seasons going like, is this queer baiting? Is it queer subtext? Is it queer coding? What is going on here? And then it turns out, like, spoilers, I'm very sorry for everyone who hasn't seen Hannibal yet, that Hannibal Lecter in the Brian Fuller canon is actually, I don't know what he would, you know, designate himself. Like, I think to him, sexuality is irrelevant, like gender is irrelevant. But for intents and purposes, we'll say he's like pan. He's probably pan. And I had no idea that that was what I needed in my life until that moment. Like, it kind of changed a lot of things for me because that character is horrific. Like, he's almost mythic in terms of his place in the cultural zeitgeist.
He's the devil.
Yeah, like, he's the devil, basically. And also I would say, side note, the devil has been portrayed as queer or queerish many times.
Mm-hmm.
But like, the Lecter character is so completely unlikable, definitely the antagonist of the story and of the main character, Will Graham, but also he's the love interest and he's one of the other POV characters. And he's, you know, if you're, I guess, me or the majority of the fandom who watched the show, like, really interesting, and you kind of rooted for him despite the fact that he was chaotic evil. Like, it was just an interesting thing to see this character subverting so many of the queer villain tropes, because I really, until the third season, thought that it was basically queer baiting or queer coding. I was like, I don't know if I trust this. Like, this seems like, you know, a cooler version, a more surreal version of the same shit that I've seen for many years in media. And then to have that completely decimated in the third season and be like, no, he's actually in love with Will Graham. Like, this is actually a really fucked up love story. It's like, holy shit, when did this happen?
Like, yeah, there's something I think super, like, strangely validating about when creators actually go there.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't just use kind of queer aesthetics and queer stereotypes as a shorthand for villainy. It's like, no, he's actually queer. Like, there's something about that I think is strangely compelling.
It is compelling, but I feel like as queer people who consume media, we're so attuned to subtext, and we're so attuned to being let down or manipulated by creators who make media that involves queer baiting or involves queer coding. Because again, it's like, oh, well, we didn't actually get it. Or when we did get it, it was like, oh, this character is diabolical and, you know, they're framed by the narrative as being terrible people. Like, ooh, I'm so excited. Like, can't wait to add this to my list of characters I love. But when you have, you know, all of that sort of foundation laid and then it ends up being true, you kind of heave a sigh of relief. Like, oh, so I'm not hallucinating. Like, this is something that actually happened. Like, because you'll see in a lot of shows with queer baiting, the creators will say like, no. Like, that's just in the eye of the beholder. The audience is doing that. We don't really intend for it. Even when it's super blatant queer coding, like, I'm gonna have to call some people out. It's kind of, you know, Supernatural-esque or even BBC Sherlock-esque. Like, it's really, really deliberate queer baiting. And yet it's sort of like hand-waved by the creators. And you kind of are sitting there going like, no, I'm pretty sure I'm not imagining this. I'm pretty sure that this is something that's actually happening in front of my eyes. Like, I feel like it's a weird kind of gaslighting.
Yeah, it's actually really funny. I have an ongoing list that I just keep to myself of problematic queer characters who I love anyway. And I hadn't looked at the list for a long time because happily I hadn't had to add any for a long time. They're mostly queer villains, but I just looked at it. And the last entry on the list from several years ago was Hannibal Lecter, I hope.
Your wishes came true. By the way, yep. Austin still hasn't finished season 3 of Hannibal. So I'm not speaking as specifically as I would like to, but I think you kind of knew going into season 3 that it was super gay. And so when we started watching it, you were expecting a level of gay, but it just kept...
It's so gay. Yeah. I had... The only reason I was watching the show, because I did not like the second season very much, was because I had heard that they actually stepped out of the queer baiting zone and into the canonical queer zone. But it was so much more than I expected.
Yeah, and they also gave us bonus queerness with an FF pairing that I absolutely love and wish there was more representation for with Margot and Alana, an existing character who had been sort of relegated, in my mind, to, like, limp-wristed love interest status. Like, she hadn't really had any agency for a season and some. So it was really awesome to see that subverted as well. Like, she ended up being bi and getting together with the, again, like, sorry for spoilers, people who haven't seen it, but maybe I'll put a tag up on the episode description. FYI, Amanda spoils season 3 of Hannibal. Just in case you care about that. I was going to say too, when I was compiling my list of fave queer villains, I noticed that one of the themes was a lot of argument over whether or not they were queer from the general audience. One of the examples I have is Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy, and then also Deadpool, who are both incidentally comic characters. And like the Harley Quinn and Poison Ivy thing, I don't know if anyone follows it, but it was really subtextual for a long time. Like, it was very wink, wink, nudge, nudge, reference, reference. And those are two of the most popular female characters in the DC universe, and then also arguably two of the most popular villains. And then, like, it's a thing. That is actually something that is canonical within, I guess, one strain of the comics. And then also Deadpool, people arguing about whether or not Deadpool is canonically pan. Also, weirdly, John Constantine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, people argue about whether or not... I mean, he's all... Although I will say Constantine, great example of an anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I don't know if everyone read The Talented Mr. Ripley. The main character of it is Tom Ripley, who is such a good example of the sort of manipulation and, like, sort of villainous tropes, because he actually is, like, murdery and manipulative and assumes identities and basically creates a wake of chaos wherever he goes. They actually, the movie adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley was sufficiently queer, I thought. Like, I thought it could have been a little queer, but I think that about everything. And then your personal fave, I will bring up the picture of Dorian Gray.
Yes, a wonderful example. Because I think the picture of Dorian Gray provides some good context and background for why we have so much queerness portrayed through villainy. The picture of Dorian Gray has a lot of queer subtext, but it's all wrapped up in this idea of moral corruption, and so of course all of the bad folk have to be punished in the end. And for a long time, that was just status quo in media. This is something that's been talked about a lot recently with the sort of media mess over The Hundred and its dead lesbian trope, which, as a lot of folks have pointed out, is directly kind of in the legacy of queer characters having to be dead or punished for their queerness at the end of the narrative, and how that was actually, like, required for television and film for a long time.
It was required in literature, too. Like, if you look at lesbian pulps, you could have, you know, lesbian characters in it, but they had to be villainized. They had to be, quote-unquote, crazy. And if they weren't, like, punished, they had to be dead at the end. They either had to, you know, atone for their sins, or they had to die.
And you have some of the most controversial queer novels in the kind of earlier canon are the ones that pushed back against that, like Maurice by Ian Forster has a happy ending.
I love Maurice.
The Price of Salt, first lesbian novel without a just tragic ending. And there's some interesting other ones in sci-fi. I can't remember the name of the short story by Theodore Sturgeon right now, but it came out in the 50s, I think. And it's even pretty sad, but the whole point of it was that the queer characters weren't being punished for their queerness. They were being punished by straight people. And so it was like a huge, huge bad deal. And I think queer villains for a long time are just another example of that kind of punishment. Like, you put them in a role where they're inherently going to be punished at some point because they are evil. And even if they get away with it, they're always going to be evil. And so it's kind of queer folks being relegated to a place in the narrative where they are not going to be love interests, they're not going to be heroes, they're more than likely going to die, or at the very least be locked into the moral corruption zone of representation, which is why I think it's so interesting when you get to these more recent portrayals of queer villainy where either their queerness is pretty incidental to their villainy, like Hannibal, I would say, is one where the fact that Hannibal is probably pansexual is not really a factor in his villainy. He's the devil.
He eats people.
Yeah, he's a cannibal Satan.
My new metal band, Cannibal Satan.
His queerness is kind of separated from that. Then you also have, I think, one of my personal favorite things to see is when you see characters who become villains because of the way either their internalized homophobia or transphobia or their interactions with the people around them, which have kind of driven them to be villains. Because I think that is a way more nuanced and sympathetic portrayal of how, for many years, queer folks have been fucked up by the society around them and have been driven into unhealthier lives, not because they're queer, but because of how people treat queerness.
Yeah, I feel like if you're going to have a character who is queer be a villain, some of that needs to be addressed, because it's not necessarily that they're a villain because they're queer, but like, in the context of the broader world, these things have contributed to it. Like, I can't think of a situation in which a queer character who turns into a villain could have had a particularly privileged upbringing, like, just by virtue of the fact that they're queer. You know, it's almost like you need to show the work. You need to get into the fact that this is not in a vacuum. And there are characters who, like, I was thinking of in terms of, like, their queerness isn't an aspect of their villainy. Hannibal's a good example of that. But I would also say, this is a slightly obscure reference, sorry, Admiral Helena Kane from Battlestar Galactica, who was not actually revealed to be queer on the show itself, if I'm not remembering incorrectly, but was revealed to be queer in the sort of spin-off short movie Razor. And while that did feed into some really ugly stuff about, like, stone-cold bitch lesbians, it was still, like, you didn't know that she was queer while she was being the villain of the show, or for like a season or however long that was. You found out in supplemental material, which I actually kind of appreciated, because while Battlestar Galactica has a pretty shitty track record with queer characters, at least, you know, unless you sought that canon out, you didn't know that she was queer. Like, they didn't put it in front of your face. They didn't tell you, like, she is gay and that's why she's a bitch. Like,
yeah.
It was completely incidental to her. And then I almost thought, so rewinding to things that I'm starting to realize were incredibly important to me as a young, starving queer teenager, the Anne Rice Vampire Chronicles series, and not actually like Lestat and Louis, but like Armand and Marius. And like, while I think maybe Marius could have been construed as like part of the reason why he's tormented and weird is because he's queer, but like, they're all vampires, they're all sort of variously angsty, they're all still protagonists, they're all still anti-heroes. So I feel like, you know, despite the fact that the Vampire Armand is one of the worst books in that series, but is still filled with, like, the Cinemax version of gay porn from almost start to finish, except because it's Anne Rice, she can't, I think there's one orgasm in that goddamn book, and it's when Armand is still human, because if anyone, like, cares about Anne Rice anymore, like, I realize this is 2016, but, like, Anne Rice wouldn't let her vampires come. Like, they just can't. Like, I don't know why that's where she decided to draw the realism line, but it is.
Boy.
So these vampires just kind of don't fuck, which is kind of a cool subversion, because a lot of times vampires are really overly sensualized. But that goddamn Vampire Armand, like a 15-year-old Amanda reading the Vampire Armand and just being like, this is so gay! Literally. It literally is. But they are some examples of like anti-heroes or villains who their queerness is incidental to their villainy, which I also really like. I think that maybe kind of what we're coming at here, like, there's the idea that the villainy has nothing to do with their queerness and they would still be terrible anyway. Or that their queerness, because of the way that they've been treated in society and the way that they regard themselves, has been sort of warped and it's impacting, like, their mental health, essentially. Like, it you know, you don't have a character like, God, what was one of the examples? Not necessarily Reaver, but maybe...
I would say one of my fave examples is Thomas Barrow from Downton Abbey, which is a terrible show that I hate, for the record.
Again, this is like the seventh thing that we've talked about that we do not endorse.
Yeah, but great portrayal of a queer person who is mean, hateful, manipulative, and just deeply distrustful and untrustworthy. Because the world is against him. He is a gay man, very lower class, in the starting in the 1910s, I think. And yeah, like, his whole life, everything in the world has been terrible on the basis of his queerness. And yeah, so no, he doesn't trust anyone. He doesn't think anybody will ever respect him for who he is. And then that also ties into his class. He's a servant. And he also hates the upper class for good reason. And I hate that show. However, I, at least for the first couple seasons, really enjoyed the portrayal of Thomas, because I liked how realistically he was allowed to react to that situation and the fact that he was allowed to be really angry and really hurt by growing up in a world that treated him that way.
Yeah, his oppression... Like, if you took that away from him, can you imagine how incredibly two-dimensional Thomas Barrow would have been as a character?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if he had just been, like, some asshole valet who just caused, you know, stirred up shit because he was bored and he didn't like other people.
Or if, frankly, if he had just been, like, a sad gay martyr who wasn't mad at anyone about anything he'd gone through, if he had just been like, oh, well, I know no one really means to be a giant homophobe in 1913 or whenever. I love that he is allowed to be so angry and bitter and nasty.
Yeah, I'm really happy that we are starting to get portrayals of queer characters who aren't either sad martyrs or beautiful, sainted examples of people. And that they're in, you know, like, as far as I know, the people who make Downton Abbey are straight. As far as I know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think they are. Having watched a couple seasons of that show, I have a hankering. Yeah, Thomas Bear is a great example of that, because even when he's absolutely vile, you're just like, you know what, I kind of get it. Like, fire burn those people. Like, they're not great either. Get what you can and, you know, fuck the rest.
Yeah, I feel like that is a good segue to jump into talking about romance writing, because one of the things I wanted so desperately for Thomas in all of that was for him to have some kind of satisfying romantic narrative, which, spoilers, he never does.
No. Why would they ever do that?
He has, like, I'm not going to recount all the terrible things they do with Thomas Barrow's love life, but the thing they do not do is ever give him a boyfriend.
You know what this podcast needs to turn into? It needs to turn into 2 hours of you fucking giving the footnoted version of the first 3 seasons of Downton Abbey. And then it needs to be me reciting dialogue from the show Hannibal and doing all the voices.
Like, let's be real. I can talk about all seasons of Downton Abbey except the last one. Unfortunately.
I was trying to spare you from admitting the true extent of your shame.
I kept watching that show for a long time for Thomas Barrow.
You know what? I can't even make fun of you. I did watch all of Glee, so.
Yeah.
I actually just finished the most recent season of Glee, and I remember, I don't know if you remember me screaming and coming out of my room to be like, they had a choir! A trans choir!
I do remember.
I was going to say, side note, great example of someone who takes an antagonistic role and their sort of internalized homophobia or whatever it is affecting them and making them like a pricklier person would be Santana from Glee. And like, I never think that Santana will ever be a chill, really cool person who isn't, you know, kind of aggressively antagonistic, but you can definitely see that when she accepts herself and is in a fairly functional relationship that she's not nearly as destructive. So yeah. That's an example. But yeah, talking about writing queer characters in romance.
Yeah, who have those elements of villainy or internalized homophobia or grappling with that in some way. We've already had a couple good examples from Heidi Below, who's one of my faves for writing characters who go through those things and who get really screwed up by it, which is always really validating to me.
I feel like people who listen to this podcast think that the only two authors we've ever read in our entire lives are K.J. Charles and Heidi Below. That's it.
I do have my faves.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that's kind of the problem. Like, they are our faves. But with the circumstance, like, of Heidi's books, Heidi's really good at characterization. So when she has a, like, really in-depth story about a character who's suffering from incredibly toxic masculinity and, like, can't come to terms with his own sexuality, like, of course that's going to be the thing that we refer to, because it's sort of the foundation for other things we want to see in the genre. Like, I've definitely read really terribly written books about characters suffering from internalized homophobia. And you sort of get to a point in the story where you're like, do I really want them to have a happy ending? Like, do I want them to put this on somebody else? Like, I don't think that they're going to be redeemed by finding the one. Like, I think this, you know, maybe just kind of scratched the surface of character motivation and didn't do a particularly good job of it. And I think that's kind of what we're talking about here, like writing a main character or even an antagonist who is still understandable.
Because I think that's sort of a pitfall of this kind of thing, is that do you have to strike a balance somewhere in your own writing and in your own perception of the characters of how far are they going to go? Because I think there's a lot to delve into with internalized homophobia, but it can get really bad really fast. And sometimes it does kind of stretch the boundaries of like a redemption narrative. I think those stories are still worth telling no matter what, because obviously you have cases in real life of queer folks who are so deeply closeted and so deeply awful about it that they do horrible things. And I think that's worth exploring. However, within romance, if the goal is to get them like a happy, healthy partner and a happy, healthy relationship at the end, there's sort of maybe a limit to what you can convey in like a 300-page book.
Yeah, and I mean, we're not talking about situations where you're writing about, like, a crime lord. Like, clearly they're still going to be gunning people down at the end of that book, whether or not they have their happy ending or not. Like, wow. We're not saying, like, and then they need to, you know, they need to renounce their business, and I don't know. I don't even know if you can atone for that. But, like, we understand that in certain circumstances when you're writing, you know, particular genres, like, you're not going to have the redemption narrative to quite that extreme. You sort of have to work in within whatever parameters you've established. Like, you know, the character who's just like, I can't kill people anymore. Like, I can't do it. I need to quit. Like, yeah, we understand that that's not going to be a narrative where you're going to be able to be like, and I need to put the brakes on just how likable they are, because the audience already has conceded that the main character is not just an average Joe. They're a mob enforcer or a serial killer.
Yeah, but I think at the same time, it depends on what you're portraying, and there are some things that your audience is going to be more possibly sensitive to than others. You know, for better or for worse, in fiction, I think we can abstract away a lot of ideas about violence. And if you've decided to tell a romance story about, I don't know, like a fantasy warrior who gets into a lot of violent situations, or a crime lord or whatever, I think people will come in with an understanding that that's the story that's going to get told. But if you are diving into like real serious, nasty, internalized homophobia, that's something that is going to probably impact a queer audience very differently, and very directly, potentially. And I think there are some depths from which it's hard to return from in a romance novel. So if I like, you know, if I start off a story and like the hero is gay bashing or something,
yeah,
I'm going to have a real hard time working backwards from that to being fine with it.
One of my favorite tropes is like the bully in high school who is suffering from an abundance of internalized homophobia. And then they realize, you know, as they grow up, they pull their head out of their ass or get away from the toxic environment that they were in. And then they, you know, they kind of have to 12-step it. They have to be like, I'm sorry, I'm doing the work. And then they have to, you know, they meet the person that they tormented in high school. Like, I am a sucker for this trope. I've got my little eye on any releases that might actually, you know, give me the reformed bully story.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, what's funny is, like, that is an experience that queer people have. Like, if they were closeted, if they were struggling, like, they may have lashed out to protect themselves. And that's, like, hey, that's an interesting story that a lot of people can relate to. But also, I mean, I feel like there's a wonderful element of wish fulfillment in that, too, is, like, people who were maybe on the opposite end of that lashing out get to read these stories and see, like, oh, that person will, you know, eventually be transformed and apologize to me, and I'll get my happy ending. And like, maybe, you know, it's kind of a nice way of dealing with whatever holdover emotions you might have from a situation with like that. And that is my favorite thing about romance, is there's so much opportunity to vicariously live through situations. And like, that is sort of the point of romance. Like, you want to experience the highs and the lows, and you want to be transported. And if it's something that you relate to, you know, in some cases, all the better. Like, while I wasn't particularly, like, picked on by a bully I suspect was queer, like, there's still a part of me who, you know, felt alienated as a teenager and is like, oh, this presses a button deep inside of me somewhere, and I'm super into it, and I want more of it. This is a call. Someone write reformed bully stories, please.
Well, I feel like romance has so much potential specifically to be really healing in that way for all of us who grew up with portrayals of queer villainy where the queerness is kind of restricted to these negative spaces with no happy endings. Part of the reason why queer villains in romance can be so, or queer villains as protagonists in romance can be so compelling for me, is it takes those characters who are always relegated to tragedy and demise and pulls them out of that and says, like, yeah, you may be kind of fucked up, but like, here is your happy ending. Even you, the person who was kind of the monster and the boogeyman in our childhood media, like, you get to be happy. You might have to go through some hell to get to be happy, but you're gonna get there. And I don't know, like, I so would love to take any of those stories that were the in the sad, queer, evil canon that I grew up with and see stories where they get some form of love.
You know what I want? A remake of The Rope, that classic movie. Was it Hitchcock? Oh, shit. I don't remember who did that. I hope it was Hitchcock because I've just said that on a podcast for the rest of eternity. But The Rope, these two killy dudes who are in a really... I don't remember if it was like explicitly said in the movie, but I feel like this is one of those cases where it would have been because the type of queerness that was allowed was like the evil... villainized queerness. I want a story where like they end the movie and they get away with it and no one's dead and they just sort of like whistle off into the sunset. Like that is viscerally satisfying to me. Like even stories where completely unlikable people have, you know, really hateful people have happy endings is still viscerally satisfying to me. Like, I don't care. They don't necessarily, I mean, if you want like a romance novel story, where, you know, the villain is queer, like you probably do want, you know, some resolution to that, or you maybe want a redemption arc, but just the idea of completely amoral, horrible people who are queer, like whistling off into the sunset and holding hands with their partner is delightful. Like, I would trade a host of sad queer people for a host of completely content villains.
I am so shocked that you would say that, you who loves Hannibal Lecter.
You know, it's true.
I'm a huge sucker for villainous redemption stories. Like, that is, if you want to just ping one trope that will get me almost every time, villainous redemption. And I would so love to see those stories where a queer villain, like, actually gets to come back from where they are. Like,
you know what? That exists. It exists. You know what it is? You know what it is?
What? What?
Sorry. I was just about to start quoting the intro from Xena. In a time of ancient gods, warlords, and kings, a land in turmoil cried out for a hero. But yeah, I was actually thinking about that, like, who are characters who started out as villains and had a good redemption arc, and I think Xena's a great example of that. And you know, Xena's queer as hell, so
queer as hell.
If anyone ever argue, like, I realize that this is a discussion that's been going on since the dawn of time, but like, if anyone argues that with me, I will feel at liberty to punch them. Like, come on, man, we all know. I hope that the remake is sufficiently gay.
The creator did come out and say, like, yes, of course they're gonna be queer. I'm not the worst.
I'm not like delusional.
Yeah.
Like, I know. I love a good redemption arc. I think everybody who, you know, if you're a person who's listening to this because you love villains, like, of course everybody sort of does. If you're listening to this to learn how to write a more complex villain, like, hopefully we've said some stuff that is relatively important. I feel like this is just illustrating how incredibly desperate we are for characters who aren't killed or punished or illustrated to be the world's worst human beings because of their gayness. But really, that is sort of the bottom line of what we don't want. Like, I don't want caricatures. I don't want to have to completely not relate to the villain and have them be my only representation.
And if you're going to make a character who is evil because they're queer, make it because, you know, society has heaped garbage on them for being queer their whole lives, not just because they're somehow corrupted on the inside.
Mm-hmm. And if you're going to, you know, not address the fact that they're queer, you know what I mean? Like, if you're going to have their queerness be separate from their villainy, which I also advocate for, like, make sure that there's a strong delineation there. And I mean...
And have queer characters who aren't villains. Like, I still think we're at the point in our media history where if you want to have a queer villain, you have to have a queer hero. Like, mm-hmm. you can't not. Like,
yeah, I mean, luckily this won't be as much of a problem in queer romance, but also, I hate to take a sharp detour, but I realize we never actually defined the difference between a villain and an anti-hero, and I think that that's worth doing. I gave an example of one, which was John Constantine, and I would also argue that Tom Ripley and God, like, Hannibal maybe, and Loki, who is in the young Loki comic, actually queer. So it's not just, this isn't just a case of us having watched Thor and been like, I don't know, Loki reads is really queer to me.
Which he does.
He
but
does.
He's also canonically queer.
He's also canonically queer in actually, I think, several different iterations of the character, because, you know, it's like, are we talking about like trickster Loki? Are we talking about Loki from MCU, from the comics? Like, what are we talking about here?
Let's not get into how much I don't understand comics.
Let's not expose ourselves there.
But yeah, and I would actually argue that if you want an example in romance, Straight Shooter is a great example of something with an anti-hero who is still very much a romantic lead.
Yeah. And I mean, an anti-hero doesn't just have to be someone who does like destructive or unlikable stuff, if that makes any sense. Like when you think of an anti-hero, maybe this is just me, but I tend to think of someone who's like, has killed people, who has, you know, maybe a seedy past, who is, you know, fucking like every character that I've kind of mentioned has as a villain hasn't just been a villain because of non-lethal behavior. Many of them are definitely like killers and extremely sadistic people, but that doesn't necessarily have to be like the role of a villain. It doesn't have to be that extreme. It could just be someone who comes in and does something manipulative or selfish or orchestrates conflict, and they're in the antagonist role. Like, not everybody has to go around killing people to earn the title.
Yeah, I mean, all a villain really is embodied conflict in your story, and that easily makes it so that your villain can be your hero as well. Because, like we said, there are plenty of people who are their own worst enemies.
Yeah, and I mean, you can also, that's what we were saying too, is like, you can have a villain who gets a happy ending and like is your main character. Like, they don't necessarily have to be punished by the narrative to have, I don't know, that doesn't have to be the end of their story. Like, they don't just have to be, like, if you're writing a story about a supervillain and they're your main character, like, their antagonist, their villain is definitely the superhero. So it doesn't always have to be, like, you know, I would say the villain is the more black and white version of protagonist and antagonist. Like, they're not just an antagonist, they're a foe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like we said, like, you can be your own antagonist, you can be your own villain in a case like Straight Shooter. When I was going through the list of, because there's like a Wikipedia page and like a TV tropes page about villains through all different sorts of media, like, so few of them were women. And that's not to say that there aren't women villains, but you, and especially in queer romance, I was thinking about this, you frequently see straight women villainized in queer romance as, you know, like, maybe the baseline of this would be someone who is an obstacle between the two queer men getting together, either because of, I guess, active homophobia, or like, it's a love interest or a love triangle. You so frequently see straight women villainized in queer romance, which is like its own thing and it's difficult to unpack. But I guess the good news is that we don't have a whole host of queer lady villains. I kind of wish we had more queer female villains who weren't villainized because they're bi or because they're straight and homophobic. Well, yeah. I guess it would hard. You could still have a homophobic queer villain, but, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, I want to see the complexity that is so frequently given to male antagonists given to female ones.
Yeah, I really would like to see more of that. Actually, that's a call to action from me, is I want more queer villains who are not men. I want more women villains. I want more non-binary villains.
Yeah.
And I want the complexities of that to be explored as well, because there's so rarely moral complexity allowed for people who aren't men in media, and I really want to see that. Like, I really want more like complex, gritty, nasty characterization there. I feel like almost every non-binary character I've seen portrayed has been like super nice and positive.
Which is something.
I mean, yeah, that's good too, but...
Yeah, I would prefer that to none, is basically what I'm saying. But it, as in the case, like, we have to do better than that. I think we're definitely there in terms of portraying queer cis people. Like, come on. like, we're better than this, but in terms of portraying, like, trans and non-binary people, we are leagues behind. Like, it's not even in the same ballpark as, like, you know, expansive and thorough and complex representation. So there aren't even really, I mean, I guess there are tropes, but there aren't many, and none of them are good.
Give me more mean and angry trans people, I shout every day. So I can finally feel like I'm not alone.
Yeah, it would be nice to pick up, like, I pick up a lot of queer romances, especially contemporary queer romances, where there's, like, trans side characters. And we've talked, I think we talked about this before in the trans episode, but it was, like, they're always there to, like, be a fount of advice.
Yeah.
And they're always really good people.
Hello, I'm your wacky best friend.
Exactly. It's like, oh, God, I appreciate that you're trying to put, you know, fucking diversity into your story, but, like, I would rather not have that. Just make one of your fucking characters in the main pairing trans.
Just like, do it.
Just do it. Like, again, this is one of those cases where it's like, oh, I'm glad they're in there at all and they're not complete, you know, horrifying representations of people. But it's like, this is almost like the black best friend thing. Like, I would rather you hadn't done that. Like, it is so much more interesting to just make your main character trans, or to make your main character black, or to make your main character, you know, not just
a white cishet man. Yeah. Or a white cis queer man in this case, more usually
in this case. Yeah. So I was looking at our list of various queer villains, and one of the ones that I meant to bring up and didn't was Lex from Smallville and Lex Luthor in general. And then I realized that the reason I didn't was because he's only ever queer coded. And then I started thinking about it more and I realized that, like, okay, so, like, Smallville's a piece of shit show. It's not good, but it's watchable if you read Lex's queer and in love with Clark Kent. Like, it's so much better if you read it that way. And then I started thinking to myself, like, holy shit, other people didn't watch Smallville with this read. Like, they just watched it. Like, they just tuned in every fucking week to see what else would happen on Smallville between Clark and Lana's headband. Like, it was never, like, for them, it wasn't about this character being torn between his responsibilities and his, like, abusive relationship with his father and, like, his inner demons and, like, his love for and suspicion of this, like, 15-year-old farm boy who looks like a 30-year-old man. Like, like, no one, like, me and the contingent of slash shippers who were, like, there, like, they were there in 2001 when that show started airing, like, don't get me wrong, but, like, the general audience of Smallville, which lasted 10 seasons, didn't read Lex as queer. Like,
that's really, it's interesting how drastically differently you can read stuff when you read it through a queer lens, and when you're queer, that's kind of how you read everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's why queer baiting is so, like, as much as I hate it, like, it's really valid, because if I'm watching these things and I see shades of queerness or I see shades of myself in it, it's so much more interesting, even when it's painful, even when it's terrible. Like, I would so much rather watch, you know, fucking Supernatural thinking that Dean Winchester is bi and in love with insert your own favorite character here than watching Supernatural without that. Sorry to everyone who likes that show. But, like, it's so much richer when you're a queer person watching media if you're, like, everyone's like me. And is this what straight people feel like all the time?
Oh.
Like, are they just like, oh, everything I watch is like this? Like, oh, we're having moments thinking about what it's like to be a straight person consuming all of the media.
All of it. Man.
Like, I take scraps because, like, for the longest time, that's all that's been afforded to me and that's all that's been, like, there to make me feel interested. Like, that's all that we had. Like, I, you know, growing up, I did have a pretty good, like, awareness of what queer media there is. I grew up watching queer media a fair amount in the 90s, but like, I just can't imagine that there are people who watch just terrible media about boring completely uninteresting straight people doing terrible things and being unlikable. And like the reason they're watching it is because they're entertained by it and not because like one of the characters is reading is queer and you're really fixated on that. Like, oh shit, man. Like that just explained a lot of movies that I didn't like. That's just, ooh, this is a paradigm shift. Like it's something that I knew intellectually, but this is the first time that I've really sat down and grappled with how different the lenses are with which I view the world and your average, you know, cis straight person views the world. Holy shit, it's different.
Yeah, that reminded me actually of something, like that's why those portrayals of villains are so important to me, even though I know they're screwed up, is that if that's all that there is, I'm so attached to that. I was just remembering that this is not romance, but to me it was romance. Any time you had like homoerotic tension between a villain and a hero.
Yeah.
I was so into it on a level that was completely unlike how straight kids I knew interacted with it. I was so attracted to and attached to the tension there because it was the only time you got to see that, even if it was violent or, you know, clearly not meant to be read as queer at all. I remember the Adventures of Robin Hood, the really old one with Errol Flynn, the kind of like villainous homoeroticism between Guy of Gisborne and Robin Hood in that movie was like really fascinating to me as a young queer person before I even realized why. Like I was so into it because I was like, they're kind of hot for each other, even though they're trying to kill each other the whole time.
Yeah, there's a moment in, pretty much everyone's seen it, but like that moment in Skyfall where Silva, the villain, is like actively menacing Daniel Craig's Bond sexually, like it hands on thighs, actual menacing. And there's like a little exchange where Bond sort of keeps his cool buttoned up and implies that like this isn't the first time that he's, you know, been around that block. Like, it was such an ugly moment because it was, again, like this incredibly, you know, I wouldn't say Silva's very dimensional and he's meant to be grotesque in many ways. And he's sexually, like, he's so evil that he sexually menaces men. Like, that's kind of the underlying thing there. But when I saw that in the theater, I had a knee-jerk reaction of like, oh, holy shit. And it felt like representation.
Yeah.
And it's not.
Yeah.
Like,
but it could
not,
be.
Yeah, it could
be. It could be is the thing. Is like, that's why I want these stories where, you know, they're trying to kill each other and they're hot for each other.
Exactly.
Which brings me to something that I wanted Amanda to talk about. The timing of this episode coming out is actually going to be really perfect because, Amanda, you are running a submissions call for Less Than Three for a collection called My Dearest Enemy. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
No, at all. Yes. I want to tell you all about that. Sit down, it's story time. Ages ago, I had an idea because two of my favorite tropes are friends to lovers and enemies to lovers. And I had already kicked some ideas at my bosses at LT3 about stuff that I wanted to do or see for anthologies or collections. And the first of which was the May-December thing, Silver and Gold, that came into fruition last October. It published. And the other thing was like these two tropes, and I had kind of thought, wouldn't it be interesting to do an anthology or a collection where half of the stories were about friends to lovers and half of the stories were about enemies to lovers, like a dual thing? We've got the dual calls. We've got me running My Dearest Enemy, and we have Sam, I believe, running My Dearest Friend. And let me just tell you about the cackling and maniacal, like, hand rubbing that I'm doing. Shut up! I don't want to hear your opinions. I'm really, really, really excited. And if you've listened to this episode, you probably know why. And it's because you get to explore what it looks like when you have people antagonizing each other, when they hate each other, when they may or may not do horrible things to each other, and then they have a completely unignorable attraction, or they develop an attraction. Holy shit. I'm going to be so happy to see those submissions roll in. I'm going to roll around in them. I already know a couple of people who are planning something for it, and it's just everything in me to resist, like, shaking them and being like, have you started? Have you started this story? I had a couple questions on Twitter from people asking, like, what level of acrimony will constitute an enemy? And that's kind of in the eye of the beholder, but, like, the more acrimonious it is, the happier I'll be, because I feel like just me as a person and an audience in general is signing up for a collection called My Dearest Enemy to read about enemies and not just people who, like, had a misunderstanding and pissed each other off in a Starbucks one time. Like, there might be a really good story with that premise that's going to get submitted, and that's cool, and I'll look at it and I might take it, but I'm going to be honest, the more you delve into what it is to be an enemy, what it is to have acrimony, what it is to be opposed to somebody and not like them, like, that's what I want. That's what I would like to have. But I feel like the flip side of that is you're not going to submit something to My Dearest Friend where it's like an acquaintance. Like,
yeah.
They're going to be friends. Like, it's friends to lovers. This isn't like two people who don't particularly like each other in their study group to lovers. So the call for that closes July 31st of this year. And I believe the word count minimum for that is 20K.
Yeah, 20 to 50.
Yeah, so it's not an anthology, it's a collection call. So the stories will be sold individually, and I believe anything over 40K will be put in print. And there will be more details to come, but definitely check out the LT3 website and check out that call. I will be your editor. I'm sorry. I'm editing right now. I'm editing right now for our audio producer, Daria, and I'm starting to realize, like, how much of a leash I put on my horrible editorial instincts, and I think I am a villain. I think the reason I relate so much to queer villains is because I am one secretly inside, and it's just a thin veneer of professionalism that's keeping me from literally destroying my authors. That's not actually true, but it's really fun to sort of relax the lead a little bit and not have to worry about tone quite as much. And because I feel like if there's anyone on earth who understands the fact that I am secretly a supervillain, it's Daria. So that's been fun. I think that's our episode. Thank you so much for listening. I actually have one more thing that I wanted to say before we go, and that's that we, a couple episodes back, changed our hosts. We used to be hosted on Libsyn, and now we're hosted on simplecast.fm, and you probably know that, but if you don't and you use a podcast app, my suggestion to you is to delete the podcast and re-add it, because a lot of times they don't check the feed and update to the new RSS location. So if you are listening to us via our web player because your podcast app has ceased updating, like, that is probably the fix. So thank you so much. I hope you continue to enjoy, and I hope you stay tuned for our upcoming episodes. We have some great people in the pipeline. We've got Heidi Below, finally, after talking about her almost every episode. We've got Megan Durr, we've got Radcliffe, and we've got, God, who else do we have? We have Rachel Hamowitz, and we have Jim Grimsley. So those are some of the people coming up.
Yep. And as always, if you would like to continue the conversation, you can find us on Twitter. I am at AustinChanted.
I'm at Amanda HG.
And that is our show.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFore, with graphics by Keezy Young and music composed by Carly Ann Warden. Follow us on Twitter at VHR Podcast, add us on Facebook, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.